Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Welcome. I have Woody Lane, a livestock nutritionist, a forage and grazing specialist, and author of books here with us. Thank you for joining us as the guest speaker for this episode. Would you like to introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Hello, Jessica. Thank you for asking me. I'm a private consultant, an agricultural consultant. My wife and I have moved here back over 30 years ago, and have been doing that ever since. I work with farmers and ranchers and on a number of different things. They're the diets for the animals, pastures, forage, and various aspects of raising the animals on primarily on pasture. That's one reason we came to Douglas County. In Western Oregon, it's got one of the best grass-based environments in the world. My background is I have a doctorate, PhD from Cornell in livestock nutrition. And for a number of years back in the 80s, I was the extension sheep and beef cattle specialist for the University of Wisconsin, an educational role for providing education to producers all throughout the state of Wisconsin. And from there, we came here, and I've used those skills and my background to help farms and ranches here. Well, actually all over the country, but this is where I'm based, and a lot of my work is here in Western Oregon. And I've done a lot of teaching. We've set up private courses, and many farms and ranchers in Western Oregon have taken my courses, you know, like an 8-week course in forage and grazing management or livestock nutrition, just like you would be in a university, except it meets once a week at night for 3 hours for 8 weeks. And so I've been doing that as well in the last few years. I've written hundreds of articles about various aspects of nutrition and forage management and all sorts of other things, history of in agriculture. They've been magazine articles, but I have compiled them into different books. I have two books out on Amazon right now. One is on nutrition from the feed trough, and one is on forage, grazing, and soils, which is called Capturing Sunlight. And I'm finishing up a second Capturing Sunlight book, which is all about other type parts of forages and toxins and some history, as well as I've also developed ways in which farmers and ranchers can meet once a month and have pasture walks, kind of like a book club, except it's based on agriculture. And we've been doing that for more than 20 years. So I had three of those, and one right now is functioning up in the valley. So
how would people go about joining you for these pasture walks?
They're not open to the public.
Okay.
They're not. This is not the Extension Service. These are private. What happens is that the people who have become members of these things have taken courses of mine or an equivalent, getting agronomy courses from the university, or they're well-known grazers. And so therefore they're able to come in and join. And we've had members come and go. It's not like a special club or something with a hidden password. It's not that at all, but they pay a few hundred dollars a year to be members. That's not like a stamp club where you pay $15 for the whole year. I mean, it's a significant It's a significant dues, but it gives access to both to me, but also monthly people get together and be able to discuss things and share ideas and examine ideas and reinforce things. Very, very effective way of making changes on your place, reducing the risk of making those changes, reducing the risk of, you know, financial wrecks. When you hear about something on Facebook and then you go do it and spend $10,000 on it and it collapses, that doesn't happen with ours. And it's also these groups are what effectively are advanced professional groups of grazers. There's a prerequisite. They have to know stuff. So it's not a beginner's group that people don't come in and ask you, what are you talking about clover? What do you mean by that? No, we're way past. I mean, it's like equivalent going to a graduate school. If you're in the universities, there are graduate ongoing seminars, and those are for people who are in that level of education. Freshmen and sophomores are not, they don't come into those. They wouldn't understand what's going on. Plus, they would ask a lot of questions that they have a right to ask, but that's not the place for it. So these have been going on, and they're very successful. And the people who've been members of these groups have the ranchers and farmers, and they come from all over. There's beef cattle, sheep, bison, grass-based dairies, hay operators. There's even companies. I mean, the Douglas County Farmers Co-op has been a member. There's seed companies, and all of these people are sharing this information in an honest and also confidential way, because these are people who know each other. And one of the basic rules in these groups is that what's said on the pasture stays there. It does not appear elsewhere. It can't. And that allows people to share what's really happening on an operation, not what you just show in the public. And that, of course, allows honest feedback, honest evaluations, and things that you take to heart in a way that is truly supportive. We've been doing that for a long time.
That's incredible.
Well, it's not a new concept. It's just new in the United States. New Zealand's been doing it for 40 years. Australia, England, Spain, parts of Europe, Brazil. Having what we call discussion groups is we've developed it, and they're self-sustaining here. There's not a grant. We're not operating off someone of a you know a USDA grant or anything like that. Nothing. These are self-sustaining things, but they work. And if you go to a place like New Zealand and go to a discussion group there, it would go, well, it's just the same. Well, the reason is that we didn't copy them, they didn't copy us. It's the fact that they reached the same conclusion on how things can work well, and that's what happens.
Thank you. Why are animals raised on feedlots?
To make money. I'm serious.
Is that the only reason?
Primarily. That's the reason, and that's a very good question, and people would ask, oh, you know, the whole concept of factory farms and all that type of stuff. There's a lot of history there. And back before the 1950s and 60s, they didn't exist, or at least not the way we know them. You know, you didn't have a feed yard with 10,000 or 20,000 beef cattle in it. You didn't have that. People have been feeding cattle for 200 years, what they do, and feeding sheep. In fact, once I went when I was a graduate student, my faculty member, the professor I worked with, he said, you need to come with this. And he took me, he was the sheep specialist for the state sheep specialist, and he took me to a supper. An annual dinner given by the lamb feeders. And there are like 200 people showed up. Lamb feeders. It was in New York State, which is not known to be a feeding operation. Well, these were the traditional lamb feeders who would use byproducts. They would get stuff from factories, you know, food factories, and byproducts like soybean meal was a byproduct. I mean, things that are made that are the excess stuff that, you know, old asparagus that can't be put in human food. So they would feed, you know, 20, 40, 100, 200 head of sheep or 50 head of cattle on that. Or they'd have you know, this would be family farms, and they would have, you know, a place that they could market their corn through. That's where we first learned about it. You know, if you're going to get, say, $2.50 a bushel for corn, but you can actually get more if you feed it through the cattle and sell the meat. Well, that's adds to the farm's ability to distribute their market and redistribute risk. That was the way it had been for 150 years. But starting in the 1950s and 60s, something really changed, and that was the federal government. In the 50s and 60s, or the 50s particularly, the government made a, I mean, the U.S. government made a very, very distinct choice, which has been lost. No, you know, people don't. They look at factory farms and they point fingers and they get all upset. And I don't necessarily blame them. But in the 50s, the US government made a basic underlying decision to support cheap food. Because the leaders, Eisenhower and all the others who were obviously in charge of the government at that time, had all come through World War II. And they saw what submarines and planes could do to a food supply. And they made a conscious decision to have policies that would support the growth of food, particularly since after the war, there was a lot of excess factories around who used to make dynamite, right? Well, that uses nitrogen. And so they had all this nitrogen that they could create or through the Haber process out of the air. And then it was basically cheap nitrogen fertilizer. And that combined with various stimulus, government giveaways to farmers, corn, rice supports, and all sorts of complex things. Well, the amount of corn was grown was exploded, and other grains, barley, milo, which is, sorghum, exploded. And then it was cheap. Well, what are you going to do with all this stuff? Well, only a little bit of corn goes to humans, and that's the sweet corn, right? But that land could be used for other things. And so there was growing a lot of corn that could feed it through the cattle. And from that grew the feedlots or the feed yards, which by the 1970s and 80s had become this monster like Western Kansas, Northern Texas, this type of thing. And then corn has been grown on these in places where who would ever thought about putting corn in Western Oklahoma, Western Nebraska? There's no water out there. Well, there is if you dig a well, and which is why the Ogallala Aquifer is re being reduced because there's so much pulling the water out, which is for making it for animals. And I remember once I was at a in New Zealand at a person's house, a well, someone who was there who really knew stuff. And he asked me, "Why do you Americans feed grain to animals? Are you crazy?" Because New Zealand is just like Western Oregon. It's a grass-based operation. They don't feed grain. Grain's expensive. So I started to give the normal, talks, normal reasoning that you always hear, et cetera, whatever it was. And then I realized the real reason. The real reason is that if I can buy cattle, for example, I'm using cattle as the main one. If I can buy cattle and it costs me 85 cents to put on a pound of meat, 85, that's all my costs. I mean, no nonsense business things. You factor in the money that you outlay for the feed, but also the equipment and the insurance and all the other things, the labor. And if it costs me a full 85 cents to put on that pound of feed and I can sell it for 95 cents, what's the difference between that and General Motors? And so that's what it was. Now, it's not always a profitable thing, but basically, if those people who are raising those animals in those feed yards can do it for less than they can sell it for, and do it in a way that they can, that the banks agree that, yeah, you're a fair good risk and we can borrow $1 billion and do it on a big scale, well, they could do that. And the reason they can do it, very, very simply, is the American public likes to eat fat. I'm serious. That's because they can sell it for that high price. Because if, when you hear, when you see roast prime ribs of beef, the concept of prime, oh my God, we all grew up to that. Oh, what a great thing. Prime ribs of beef. Prime means fat, as opposed to select or choice. You get more fat. Oh, yeah, sure, you get marbling and you get stuff and it's more tender in some ways. But basically, you're adding a lot of fat, which is the least, at that last part of the growth curve, is least efficient. If you sell lamb in the market, you're going to get $1.20, $1.30 a pound. It's roughly somewhere in that range right now. If that animal gets a little older, so it's now classified as mutton, you're going to get 10 cents. Clearly, there's no commercial market for the mutton goes to pet food. All right. But the obviously public doesn't want to buy it, at least under that name. So if beef was the same way, those feedlots collapse. But they don't. And the reason they don't is because there's a massive public wanting that product and they're willing to pay for it. Do I agree with that? I think there are nicer ways. There's better ways of raising animals where they can basically, because when you're taking these cattle and sheep and whatever else you're going to put in there, dairy, most of the dairies, most of the milk that you get is from confinement dairies that are really pushing the nutritional thing, but they're basically fed, 50 pounds of grain a day. What you've done is you've taken the main strength of these cattle animals that can eat grass. We'll get to that a little later, but and then turning them basically into chickens. You're feeding them the same type of stuff that you'd feed chickens, turkeys, and hogs. And they're doing it because it's profitable. Does that
Wow,
answer your question?
that answers the question. Yeah,
But there are a
thank
lot of
you.
things that people cut, there's a reason for it. It's not because you got, Simon Legree, bad person with a cape and big mustache going to say, I'm going to hurt people. No, it's not like that at all. These are business people, men and women who are trying to make a living, and this is a way of doing it. And yeah, there's a whole culture built on it, and there's no question about that. But the end result is there's a market that's willing for it, and they're willing to pay those prices.
So, sticking with the feedlots, is there a common nutritional disease associated with feedlot livestock?
People say it hurts their rumen, and so no. if it's that's why you have good nutritionists. No, it doesn't. There are a couple of things that happen that can happen. There's acidosis. It's the biochemistry metabolism that goes on in cattle and sheep in the rumen. But when the stuff ferments in the rumen, the microbes in there release acid. It's not hydrochloric acid, but it's a but they are well, they are acidic compounds, and they are acids. They're small acids. Well, if they do too much too fast, the buffering capacity of the rumen is overwhelmed, and some of that acid goes into the blood, and you end up having it reduces the blood pH, which is very, very critical. Once, because the blood pH is absolutely critical for hemoglobin to carry oxygen and all sorts of things, and they're very, very carefully balanced against at the pH. You change the pH a little bit. Say the pH goes from like what 7.4, I forget what it is, but it drops a little bit, has tremendous physiological problems. And that's called acidosis. And that is a risk in feedlot situations. It's not a risk usually out on pasture, unless you get some very, very high quality pasture that's got a lot of sugars in it. But basically, if you end up in a feed yard, it's a common situation. So the diets are adjusted accordingly. Buffers are put into it. Enough fiber is put into it to stop things. So therefore, it's a rare thing, and you manage for it. That's one thing. Liver abscesses. These are problems of, again, too much grain. Again, that's one of the reasons they put drugs. They had drugs in the feed, which is going to end. But the end result, yeah, there's a couple of things there. You're basically taking an animal that was evolved onto grass and fiber and making it into a chicken. Yeah, things are going to happen to it that are not necessarily. They could be health problems, but they're health problems on pastures too. So we know a lot about these things. Like, for example, if there's too much grain that goes into a cow, the cow will produce, as a percentage of its diet. Say, why don't you just feed straight corn and enough protein to be happy? If you do that, the cow starts producing low-fat milk. It produces skim milk. The milk percentage drops from 3.5% to 1%. It's called milk fat depression. We know enough about that, and nutritionists in the dairy industry adjust the diets to prevent it. They're routine things from the course of dealing with animals in a feed yard situation, which equates to putting animals in a very high grain situation.
So, how often do you assess the nutrients and what they're needing? And is it specific for each animal or is it based on the whole lot of the
Well,
whole?
you don't, it's not like a restaurant. You feed by groups, but you
Okay.
have like groups. You have, let's say you're feeding cattle, if they're feeding feed yards, and I don't really want to talk too much about feed yards in this, but because that's an anomaly, not where we want to go. But in a feed yard, in a pen of animals, that they're going to be pretty much the same age and the same weight. So you feed them all the same thing. I mean, you're not giving individual stuff to each animal. It's not like they come through. Well, that does change, however. That's how a feed yard operates. Dairy, same thing, large dairies, except now more and more dairies are going into robots, using robots for milking. If you ever watch that, it's kind of fascinating. Go into this pen situation, and they stand there, and all these little things come out, and there's sensors, and it's fascinating. You see these infrared sensors and everything, and the udder is it starts to be milked, and it's in and but when they come in, they have a thing around their neck, an electronic sensor, which and then there's this feed pen. There's this little thing that you could put they could put their head in, and the computer reads the sensor and drops the appropriate amount of feed into the pen for that animal. So that animal gets individual plates, if you will. That happens because you have robotic sensors, and that's done, and it's being done. And there's also stuff that's they use that same equipment or similar equipment in experiments now where we can measure, you can put a bunch of animals in a pen. Because an animal by itself is not cattle and sheep, they're herd animals. So an animal by itself is not necessarily going to consume the same amount in the same way as a group of as it would be in a normal behavior. So you really want them to know what's going on in normal behavior. So by putting animals in a pen, they all kind of happy and that's their. But we now have equipment where an individual animal can go up to the feed trough and get its certain amount coming in, and we can also measure how much it eats individually, which, 15 years ago that was impossible. But sciences, engineering, computing has allowed us, given us much more tools to do that. And by so doing, we've learned a lot about more about nutrition, about what the animals really need, and the differences in different types of animals, and how some animals are genetically more efficient than other animals. Okay, we sensed it, but we didn't know how to measure that, and now we do. So
Wow.
these are things that livestock nutrition isn't what it was 80 years ago, and it's very precise. It's particularly on these very high producing things like those confinement dairies that are producing 30,000 pounds of milk per cow per year. That's a lot of milk, but they're on the edge in terms of nutrition. I mean, they're pushing the knowledge of nutrition. The cows are healthy. I mean, they try to keep them healthy. There's no one I know who raises livestock, whatever level of livestock, at least the people I've worked with and who raise cattle, dairy cows, sheep, goats, bison. Every single one of them wants to raise healthy animals. They don't treat animals like it's, chairs on a manufacturing line or cars being made. It's not like that. They're animals. And they're when you raise animals, you have the obligation to raise them so that they're healthy. That includes in a feedlot, but that's not really, the feedlots are an anomaly. It's an American, I wouldn't say an American, but it's an anomaly based on the economics and the ability to raise vast amounts of grain in ways that have been subsidized a lot. All sorts of subsidies go in. There's all sorts of different ways in which subsidies are created. And you know this in the environmental community, logging, the true cost of logging, a lot of those environmental costs are passed down. So they don't have to, so the companies don't have to pay them. Same thing occurs in agriculture in certain types. It allows these feedlots to exist.
So, do you think if it was possible to narrow it down to one nutrition, there would be one nutrition that all livestock consider most important?
No, much more complicated than that.
Okay.
I know that's the bumper sticker thing that everybody likes to see. That's what you see on Facebook or Instagram or whatever else. The reality is much more complex than that, and people don't like complexity, or they don't understand it, and they're scared of it. The end result is, I mean, it was, say that in humans. What's the one thing that you have to have? Well, all right, don't have vitamin C for a long enough time. I mean, nutrition's complex. That's one reason I taught it, would teach classes for 7 or 8 or 9 weeks. It's complex. People are uncomfortable with that because it's complex. What can you say? There's no one thing, whether fat, protein, energy, starch, all of those interact in so many ways. And, what can you say? Biotin used to be one of the main causes of problems. Riboflavin, beriberi. A horrible disease until they figured out thiamine was the was until they figured out there's such a thing as a vitamin, which back in the 125 years ago they didn't know that. Much more complicated thing, and there is no one single thing, as much as reporters would like to identify that for their editors. No, I that's why we that's why there are PhDs in nutrition, because it is complex.
Wonderful, thank you. So, livestock on pastures, do they destroy the land? And under what conditions would this occur?
Overgrazing, badly managed grazing will destroy land. And it's not the livestock itself. I could take goats and I can have magnificent, like the look behind me, I have magnificent pastures. Or I could take goats and turn it into a desert. I can do either one. But it takes knowledge to properly manage the land. Again, the US government screwed up back in the 1800s, big time. They did two things. They passed the Homestead Act, and they did not have a way of managing public lands until 1935, or effectively. The Homestead Act, which was passed in the 1860s, gave people go out and plow, raise something on 160 acres, and it's yours after 5 years. I think that's what it was, if you own up to it. So all these people from the East and Midwest went west, and they plowed the land, and they tried to raise wheat out there. And there was this whole thing as grain will follow the plow. 15 years later, they were all bankrupt. And welcome to the place that caused the dust storms. What they did is they took prairie, mostly short grass, long grass, but definitely short grass prairie, where the rains are quite variable and quite low. You can get, you get 11 inches of rain a year. That'd be great if it happened every year, but the variation goes, it goes, you get 20 one year and two the next. That's the nature of the climate. But they plowed that land and they broke ground. And when they broke ground, when they broke sod, they opened it up. And, they went bankrupt because they couldn't raise a crop every year for enough to do that. But the damage they did was so disastrous. And that was because the government set up a program that allowed it. And gave them a reward for doing that. And then the other part of this, it wasn't until 1935 the Taylor Grazing Act came in. Before that, sheep and cattle were first come, first serve. The tragedy of the commons. I mean, you can see this in Eastern Oregon, the Catlow Valley and all that. It used to be gorgeous grassland, and now it's sagebrush, or parts of it are. They're trying to restore it. But this was beautiful grazing country, but it wasn't controlled. It was like, okay, you should come on. If I get my herd on there first and get my animals so they can eat it, I got it before the next guy gets in. And the cattlemen were more organized than the sheep guys, so the cattle sheep wars usually went against the sheep guys. But it was all based on the availability of feed or the lack of availability, and that was because there was no control. Okay, and because once you go west to the Missouri River, with a lack of rain, it doesn't heal quickly. I mean, you can go to the Idaho border and still see the tracks of the emigrants from the on the Oregon Trail. That would not exist in Michigan, but it does exist in Oregon. It doesn't heal quickly. So places where you see overgrazing in environments that are very brittle, it's a absolute disaster. Now, people didn't do it so they say, I'm going to destroy the land. Great, good for me. It wasn't that. They just saw, I need to graze my cattle or sheep because that's I need the feed so I can sell them. They didn't think about the land. So, of course, grazing or animals on pastures got a bad rap, and deservedly so. But it was the managers, not the animal. I mean, a good, well-managed pasture, whether it's in fairly dry country, and I'm not talking range country, that's a different situation, but it's something you could control. Or in areas like ours, which got 35 inches of rain, good year, but it gets rain, is magnificent. We can build. I mean, this has been finally well established now. It builds organic matter. It captures carbon. We're not quite sure how much carbon, but it rivals that of forests. A good man, well-managed pasture that's grazed multiple times, because every single time. It's something to do with rotational grazing in some way, intensive grazing. So every time you go through and leave enough residual, the forages spring back. And each time they spring back, they produce more roots. And those roots are what becomes ultimately the organic matter. Those roots are what's capturing the carbon. So really good grazing is tremendously good for the land. It also keeps it good, well covered, as opposed to overgrazing, which opens it up. These are things I teach. So yeah, grazing can destroy, animals can destroy the land. Yeah, they can turn into a desert. The way the animals are managed and the way the pastures are managed, what we're trying to teach people is that yeah, they raise animals, but what they are really are grass farmers. They are capturing sunlight, which is what my book is all about.
That's a great explanation. Is there a specific type of grazing system or a variety of grazing systems that are commonly used?
Well, there's a whole lot of them. The easiest one is where people just put the animals out and come back in about 3 months. That's called set stocking. You put them out there, and what that does is it lets the animals keep on eating the chocolate till the chocolate's gone, and then they move on to Brussels sprouts, right? But they'll leave stuff, and what comes in are weeds, and the good pa and the good and the good forages are overgrazed and killed. That's common. What I teach and what's being taught is not to do that. And how damaging it really is to the pasture, and to properly put animals through. And we call it management intensive grazing, and there's different names for it, but it's moving animals through. And people think, oh, it's intensive grazing, like, oh, you get animals in little areas and you move them to the next one. No, it's not. It's not intensive grazing, it's intensive management. It's a thinking person's way of managing the land. And so you're moving animals according to what they need to be into places where they need to go next, and leaving enough green stuff there so it both covers the soil but also captures and it's able to grow back quickly. We can do that. We know enough to do that. Why people don't is lack of knowledge usually. Sometimes it's more trouble than they think it's worth, and people don't want to necessarily change. I don't disagree with any of that, but that is the nature. We can make, like our area right here, going up and down the roads, you could see overgrazed pastures all the time. And every now and then you'll see one that's not. You know, that person knows what they're doing. And you just stand and look at it. It's like, oh my gosh, we can do that everywhere. But there's all sorts of reasons, as you can imagine, why not.
Do you
So,
think larger farms or operations, the amount of people plays a huge role in that type of
no,
grazing method?
because you don't need zillions of people. It's not like you get armies of people out there. No, it takes one person to open the gate.
Okay.
Animals, once they learn that every time you show up, you're the sign of good food. You don't have to drive them. You get out of their way. I mean, you open the gate, and you take, you know, two or three or four times doing that, they learn. Cattle, sheep, goats, bison, they know that, you know, when you come and open the gate, there's good food on the other side of that gate. So, you know, that's not an issue. Managing an operation, even a large operation, is a business. I mean, it takes time and effort, and people have to run a business. That's the things we talk about all the time. Yeah. One of the beauties of being in Western Oregon is the fact that it rains. And if you have irrigation, you can actually grow forage 12 months a year. And we have techniques now like bale grazing and swath grazing. Those are ways, if you have frozen ground, say in you know, on the east side, or places where you can say grow something like barley, some annual crop like barley, and in the fall cut it and let it lay into windrows, the long rows of down, and then you let the animals go walk to that during the winter. Not our winter, but their, you know, winter where there's a winter. Or you make these big bales. You've seen them, the big white mushrooms out on the middle of the pasture. Well, those are basically little silos, and it's airtight wrapping. And you can do those, and you can put them all over a pasture in a grid formation, and then open one up at a time and let the animals eat it one at a time and move that through. You can do that all winter long. And in places where there's something called tall fescue, you can let the fescue just grow and have standing feed come November, December. That's done all through the southeast parts. So we have techniques that allows farmers and ranchers to feed forage 12 months a year. But I need to say this: it's a very, very important thing. And I know the questions come up is why even have animals at all out there? Why not just have, you know, I don't know, raise chickens or something like that? My question to you is, what is the largest, highest amount of feedstuff in the world? How, in terms of tons? I know you don't need a number, but what is the stuff that's the most amount of potential food in the world for humans? Whatever. If you're growing something, what would be the thing? What
I would say
material?
grain, some form of grain.
It's fiber. It's cellulose. Every plant, all that fiber in every plant is cellulose and related products called hemicellulose. That is the fiber that we talk about. All right? Cellulose, which is in its pure form, is cotton thread. But cellulose is, and hemicellulose, it's cousin, if you will, biochemical cousin. That is the form that those compounds are fibers. That's fiber. And it's one or two others that are in there that are lignin and stuff that are also part of that. In terms of tonnage in the world, that's the stuff that's more of it than grain. Here's the deal. In order for anything to digest and get nutrition from something, they have to digest it. I mean, you can't just put it in your mouth. It's got to come through and then get digested so those nutrients can be absorbed into the blood and then used for whatever we're going to use it for, right? In order to do that, in your gastrointestinal, in your stomach and small intestines, gastrointestinal tract, you have to have enzymes that break down these things. All right? That's if you might have learned that in high school biology. I mean, you need the enzymes in the digestive tract to digest these large molecules, break them down to small molecules so they can be absorbed. The thing about it, we don't have the enzyme to break down cellulose or hemicellulose. We don't have those enzymes. No mammal does. In fact, no large animal does. However, so we actually can't eat fiber and survive. However, microbes can. Bacteria, protozoa do have those enzymes. So what happens is that animals have evolved places in their gut where those microbes survive. In humans, it's the large intestine. You've heard of the microbiome. That's what it is. And so therefore we can eat lettuce and actually gain a little bit from it. We're not designed really well from it, and we'd starve to death if we had to live on wet lettuce, but we can get some things from fiber because the lower tract, there are some digestion that goes on. Hogs have a little more than humans in terms of its body weight, but the ones that really do a good job are ruminants or other animals like that. They have a huge rumen, plus they've got their large intestine. So they have places that are, that's what they do. And the food, all this stuff, all this fibrous stuff goes into the rumen, gets broken down, and then the products of that they live on. It's a very nice system. And then we, as humans, can get food and wool and other products from those animals, which we couldn't otherwise, from that land. In addition, that fibrous stuff, which is primarily forage, even a grain plant, most of it's forage. It's only the top, the little seeds, the grains. All of that stuff, in order for animals to eat it, they have to convert that into animal products. And then we can feed and, it's for human use. They also, forage is much better than grains, cover the land, save the soil. Look, how you go to the Midwest, they used to have how much, or they used to have 7-8% organic matter in those soils, and now they got 1%. That didn't happen automatically. That happened because they plowed it every year. Whereas if you have a pasture, if you have forages, you can add to the soil organic matter. We know that. We would never have dust storms out of pastures. Those dust storms came from mismanagement of open land. So when someone says, well, oh, we can take all that land that's growing corn, we can grow cauliflower and all sorts of good stuff. Well, you'd have to do it without plowing. I mean, it's not impossible. And in fact, I just read that in the Netherlands, they have vertical urban farms that are exceptionally efficient. It's great. I mean, we're talking horticultural vegetable type stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. But for saving the land, covering it with pastures, covering it with forages, and then being able to harvest those forages in a meaningful way and an intelligent way so you don't overgraze. I don't disagree with that at all. If you overgraze, you screwed up things just as badly as anybody. But if you have proper management, good management of the animals, but proper management of the forage and the soil, you build a resilient and healthy ecosystem. We know we can do that. And it's being done on the best farms. And, the university is trying to support that various ways. But you go to YouTube and look at Gay Brown and Ray Archuleta and all sorts of people like that, Jim Gerrish. We know what we're talking about. It works very, very well. It doesn't necessarily make the front pages of something because that's not where things, there's a whole sociological thing going on there. But it does work. And some of the basic principles of good health, of good soil health, rather, is that keep your soil covered, have a diverse group of plants so you got absorption from all sorts of stuff. You've got a healthy fungus population in the soil. You minimize the soil disturbance so you don't plow or disc, or very rarely you do. You can occasionally, but make sure there's a continuous flow of plant life, and use livestock to help manage that. And also, what livestock does, the saliva contains, I've read this, I didn't do the research myself, but I've been to professional meetings where they've talked about this. The saliva has some compounds in it that stimulate some plant growth. Now, I don't know much about that, but I remember Dennis Hancock, who's a was a forage specialist from Georgia for many years, said that. He says the saliva has it's there's an interaction going on. It's not just like a parasite where the animals just eat the stuff. No, there's more of that. Plus, the manure is spread and it's taking material and redistributing it. So there's lots under good, again, it comes down to good management. Mismanagement, You get a desert. Fair enough. But we have enough knowledge to do good management. New Zealand, they do a good job of that, or have been. So there's lots of things that we can do. And of course, I know fingers are pointed at agriculture because look at all the greenhouse gases that are coming out. You want to talk about that?
I would like to. I actually have a question. So, what's the difference between raising ruminants like cattle and sheep compared to the non-ruminants like hogs and chicken? What is the environmental difference?
Well, a couple of differences. Number one, ruminants can live on fiber. That's their specialty. I mean, you can turn them into chickens by putting them in a feedlot or a confined barn and feed them high levels of grain. But going out when they're grazing in pasture or they're eating the hay and stuff like that, they're ruminants and they're eating feed that we can't eat. If you think about it, chickens and hogs are competing for food for us. They eat the same stuff we do. Whereas when raised on pastures, cattle and sheep and goats do not. I have a problem with using a lot of feed and then feeding animals that are actually competing for us, competing with humans for food. Whereas there's other animals out there that can be raised such that they don't compete with us for food.
That makes sense.
And in order to feed those hogs and chickens, you've got to raise grain. Okay. So is there no environmental cost to raising grain? Yeah. Well, there is. Of course, there is. Same environmental cost of having a feedlot in cattle. You're going to plow, you go open the ground, you're going to do all that because the grain has to be fed. Whereas we don't have to open the ground at all. We can have a continuous perennial pasture that's a healthy thing and still get meat from it.
So we're keeping these ruminant species on them. They're filling the niche that
I think
they're
so.
designed for.
Yep. And
Yeah.
manage properly because they can, poor management screws things up badly. Now, without any question, poor management will turn a healthy soil into a desert. I mean, but we know how to do that, so it's not done like that.
Yeah. So livestock and greenhouse gases, is this true? How much do they output? Do livestock really add to the greenhouse gases and one species more than another?
Okay, this is a very, very good question. It's obviously the one that, people point at livestock, and rightly so. Oh, they give off methane. All right. Ruminants, the whole fermentation, what we call anaerobic fermentation, that means fermentation without air. That's what happens in the rumen. Same as your septic tank, which is kind of weird thinking of that. They are walking septic tanks, right? But that process, without going into all the chemical detail, a final product, byproduct of that process is methane. We know that. I mean, there's no question about that. It happens in humans too, but not nearly to the extent. All right. But that's what ruminants, and other things, llamas, alpacas, hippopotamus, I mean, whatever, termites. The fermentation process of fiber, of anything, not just fiber, grains ferment in the rumen as well. But the end result of that is a whole cascade of biochemical actions. But the end result as a byproduct of it is a one carbon compound, because you start out with these long chains, these cellulose, or these long chains with thousands of carbons, get broken down into, and finally you get these compounds with four, three, and two carbons. And those things get absorbed, but the last one, the one carbon one, does not. That's methane. And it is released, and they call it, the scientific term is eructation. Everyone else calls it burping. But ruminants, and they don't stand there and do things like you would in a bar. No, it's a quiet, steady stream of gas that's released. And yes, that is released. And it's small levels, but it's released, and you put a lot of ruminants together over time. And then everyone points to that and goes, look, greenhouse gas. Well, I want you to think about something. There's a faculty member down at UC Davis. I listened to him talking, Mitthauer, I think his name is, University of California, Davis. Pointed out something called the biogenic cycle. Absolutely blew my mind. Methane is a single carbon atom. I mean, a single carbon molecule. One carbon, four hydrogens around it. It goes up in the atmosphere. We know that it's a greenhouse gas, and we know it's what, 37 times more effective than carbon dioxide of its actions in terms of capturing the allowing the buildup of heat. But what happens that methane? And we know this. It breaks down in 10, 12, 14 years. In that range, that molecule gets oxidized into carbon dioxide. Other methane will replace it. But I'm saying that particular carbon, now follow this thing. You got this one carbon molecule, that after 10 or 12 or 15 years becomes a one carbon molecule called carbon dioxide. It sits around for who knows how many years, but eventually that carbon molecule is then absorbed by a plant because a green plant does photosynthesis. And the basic equation for photosynthesis is green plant with a chloroplast gets the light from the sun and takes, and the formula is water plus CO2 is equal to sugar. It's a three carbon sugar, but still the end result is you take two of those and two three carbon sugars, you get six carbon sugar, which is glucose. But that's what happens in a plant leaf. So you got CO2, carbon dioxide, and water, which is brought up from the from the soil, equals a carbohydrate. And then the plants take these carbohydrates and make more plants. So that carbon has now entered the plant. That same carbon is now in the plant. And then what happens to the plant? The animal eats the plant. And in the formation of the rumen and whatever else, it comes back out as methane. It's a cycle. That carbon goes up and around through that cycle. It might take, who knows how many years. But here's the big thing about it. Has it added anything to the atmosphere? That same carbon is flowed, made a cycle. Yeah, there's some loss here and there. But the bottom line is that that methane given off ultimately will end up back in the animal through the plants. How we add to the atmosphere is get more animals. Okay, you add more animals, then there's going to be more carbon, more methane being given off. But if you have a steady state bunch of animals, which, there might have been 60, 70 million bison here before Europeans arrived, and we have that many sheep and cattle now. Okay, given without throwing decimal places around, yeah, there's some methane given off. Absolutely. And yes, methane is a greenhouse gas. But is there much addition to the atmosphere? Probably not very much compared to taking carbon out of the ground and burning it. So you've got oil or coal, which has been laid down geologically but from biological processes millions of years ago, taking it out, burning it, throwing that CO2 into the air. Yeah, there's methane given off. But I don't disagree that you point fingers and say, oh my God, the animals are causing all these problems. Every time you open up the ground on a with a plow or a disc, you are allowing something that doesn't have much oxygen into lots of oxygen, and now it breaks down and all that, and there's CO2 given off. So it's not a simple thing, but it's also not simplistic. The ruminants that produce methane aren't necessarily adding to the problem. They're recycling. Yeah, they're recycling it. One source of methane that is seems to be ignored is termites. They add vast amounts of methane. They're breaking down fiber. Only I've never seen a herd. I don't even want to think of a herd of termites being that's more than I want to think of. I don't want to go there. But in all fairness, there's other sources of methane which are not, at least in the short term, they're not a cycle. The loss of methane out of swamps, for example. Or what's it called, the frozen ground in the Arctic that's melting. Oh my gosh. You know how much methane is locked in that place?
I mean, it's not cycling back
Permafrost.
in, yeah,
No.
the same way
No.
that it does with animals
Right.
and photosynthesis.
It's not a simple answer, but it's not the simplistic pointing fingers at animals of ruminants and going, you see, they're causing all this, the greenhouse gas. Well, they're part of a cycle. I don't say they're causing stuff. And the reason that we have greenhouse gas increase the way we have in the last 150 years is not because of animals. It's not. We
Yeah.
have roughly the same amount of ruminants they had 300 years ago, just different species. But this it's the same fermentation that goes on. So, yeah, there might be minor differences, but nothing did not raise the CO2 levels ultimately of the atmosphere from 280 to 414, which it is now, 413. I mean, that didn't happen because there's more sheep on the place. So that's a long-winded explanation of something you probably haven't heard called the biogenic cycle, which is, basically what's going on with ruminants. Is one reason that I am so supportive of grass-based agriculture with animals, when done right, is healthy and resilient and helps the environment.
So, I wanted to talk about your book, Capturing Sunlight. That's a very cool title, and I am definitely going to be ordering it and reading it. But could you provide a little bit of information about the book and what the title means?
Well, the title means exactly what I just talked about. Effectively, that's what green plants do. They get energy from the sun, which drives in those that miracle of photosynthesis. It's not a miracle chemically. I mean, it's studied. But from our point of view, just looking at it, the energy in sunlight is captured chemically by the plants in the sense that it drives the equations that in those green leaves produce carbohydrates. That's, I mean, it's like, oh my gosh. And the carbohydrate, which is the first carbohydrate that's made, well, second or third, is glucose. So you get these three carbon units, which then are combined, two, three carbon units becomes a six carbon unit, which is glucose. And glucose is the equivalent of Rome. All roads lead to Rome. Well, all roads lead from glucose to everything. Glucose is the key to biological chemistry. I mean, you add the nitrogen and make proteins and all this stuff. But it all comes, the energy is driven by sunlight, and chloroplasts capture that. So to my mind, green plants capture sunlight. And our job as livestock raisers is to manage that to maximize the health of the plants, of the soil, the environment that they're living in. I mean, and then the animals that are raised on that or can be raised on that. So, and my book, Capturing Sunlight, which is, by the way, it is book one, and I am just finishing up book two now, which is going to be Capturing Sunlight, book two, with a different subtitle, is a collection of articles that I've written for the Shepherd magazine over many, many years. I wrote a monthly column in that, and I have over 300 of those articles that I've written. And so I pulled out the ones that I wanted to put in this book, and then I rewrote them and did what I wanted to make them better, and then had them copy edited. I don't know if you know what a copy editor is, but it's your worst nightmare of an English teacher. And we published a book, and so these are, each chapter is easy to read because they're only about 1500 words. Someone said it's the best bathroom reading they've ever done, but I don't know how to use that in marketing. But the book itself is about how to look at a pasture, what it means to measure it, how to manage it, how, when you're starting from scratch, what do you do? How you deal with soil and soil tests? What do those numbers actually mean? What is going on in the soil? Everything from, you know, mycorrhizae to whatever, root. And one of my articles is the dance for nitrogen, which is how legumes in the pea family, things like alfalfa and clover, peas, how does that plant actually bring nitrogen into the system? Because there's bacteria in the soil that combine, literally combined in the roots of these plants. And those bacteria have an enzyme in it called nitrogenase, which then captures the nitrogen from the air and makes it into plant, well, amino acids ultimately. That's a miracle. I mean, how does that do that? We know how it does it. How does that plant communicate with these bacteria in the soil? What goes on is a dance. It's a whole bunch of things that happened in the bacteria and then actually happened in the roots as they grow to make that happen. I talk about that. Talk about, you know, basically, it's not a textbook. What it is all these different subjects and the background information about those subjects, hopefully in a readable way, because I wrote them as magazine articles, not as a textbook. So they're written in active tense and shorter sentences than the convoluted legal contract. You know, I have one chapter there on dinosaur nutrition.
When will your new book be ready to order?
The new book, probably in a couple of months, for sure.
Okay.
And they're all on Amazon. I mean, you type my name in, Woody Lane book, and I've got another one called From the Feed Trough, which is all about nutrition. So that's more nutritional aspects of it, and energy, protein, that type of thing. But the one on capturing sunlight is exactly about what we're talking about grazing, about good grazing, bad grazing, what fiber is all about, you know, what really, from a nutritional point of view. And of course, I think it's interesting, but hopefully other people do it. One thing I would like to add, think about the methane. There's a lot of science now going into trying to find ways of reducing the amount of methane given off. And the two main things they're talking about, one of which is garlic. Yeah, this garlic will help. I hate to just think of what that means when you go into a barn with, you know, 200 sheep that have just eaten a lot of garlic. but the other one is seaweed. And there are types of seaweed that when fed will, and it's clear, very clear, it does reduce the amount of methane given off. That's very interesting because it's seaweed. Mm-hmm. However, and I want to say this because people will tout it. You'll read about it on the internet. You'll see all this stuff going on, how great this stuff is. Best thing since sliced bread. In the scientific community, there is some research, serious research being done. Well, what we're finding is that seaweed is extreme. Some species of seaweed is extremely high in iodine. Now, iodine is a nutrient that you need, but in small amounts. Having lots of iodine, very, I mean, instead of having 50 parts per million, there's 1,000 parts per million. We're talking a large amount of stuff. So there's that, and what that effect could possibly be, and what the toxicity levels are. Like horses are very, very susceptible to high levels of iodine, much more than other animals. What happens if it comes through in the meat and we're eating it over time, or the milk, more likely? All right. That has to be studied carefully in all seriousness. And then seaweeds have a compound called bromoform, kind of like the word chloroform, but with bromoform. So it's a bromine compound. That could be dangerous. We don't know this yet. The EPA has designated that as a potential carcinogen. Okay. I mean, it is what it is. A lot of research has to be done before you start feeding this stuff to animals. Seriously. I bring this up because the research is being done. I mean, I don't see scientists jumping up and down saying this is the best thing since sliced bread. They're going the same way I have. You go, we need to know more about this before we start feeding it to animals. Because there's a report that just came out of Germany where they fed industrial hemp to dairy cattle. This was out of Germany, and I know the same types of research is being done in Oregon State. Industrial hemp has low levels, by law, very, very low levels of THC, so it's not marijuana. Okay, it's the same plant, but it's got very low levels of the alcohol of the cannabinoid that causes the psychoactive impact. Well, what they found though is they fed this stuff, and the milk had THC in it, detectable levels of THC. It shouldn't have, but it did. So what's going on there? We don't know. Obviously, these cannabinoids are coming through and are being stored in the animal and then coming out in product. So before we go ahead and start feeding this stuff to animals and letting it go in the open market, putting it in a feed yard diet, for example. No, it's got to be studied very carefully. Seaweed, things that we would add to feeds to reduce methane, needs to be studied very carefully before. And in the United States, it would be. Because we know there's compounds in it that have a problem, so FDA has to pass it, and FDA has exceptionally strict rules, which is good. So, any case, I bring this up because it is a part of the story of the methane.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be a guest on this episode of Living Downstream.
Thank you for asking me, Jessica.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.